Mr. Foley, we're going to look at one of your movies. We're going to look at the opening 5 minutes of Perfect Stranger. And we're going to try to understand some of the microdynamics of the patterns that you use to have emotional impact. Mm. So we're going to look at some of the techniques that you use to have emotional impact in the first 5 minutes of Perfect Stranger, and eventually we'll get around to thinking about how those things could be applied, how they could be used in the healing arts, taking things from the creative arts, moving them to the healing arts, how we could take things from the creative arts and even bridge them into everyday life so that people who wanted to talk more effectively with their children, with their spouse, talk more effectively at work, could take some of the techniques that you're using and apply them in their everyday life. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, things are a little dissociated. This is art. This is everyday life. But there's lots of wonderful things that you do that can have direct applicability in everyday life. So we're going to jump into action.
Sure.
And jumping into action, that's something that you did in the chamber, where you immediately started, and the movie started when you jumped into action and you saw the explosion and you realized that people were killed, and we were going to see a story about that. So yeah. Let's take a look at the opening of Perfect Stranger. So this is what you need from Revolution Studios.
Yes, that
is their logo. But in the background, you are showing...
Introducing... deep into
the human eyeball. You're looking inside the retina.
A human eyeball into the nerve, yes, right into the retina, into the nerve endings. And the point was that I wanted to establish that what our focus is going to be is to go deep inside the internal mind of the main character, Halle Berry. And so even though when the movie proper starts, it's working on one surface level of reality, but I wanted the audience to be sort of primed to be aware of what is motivating and what wheels are turning inside Halle Berry's head.
Now, your audience has no idea of what that image is. And this is working on some relatively primitive side of the brain to stimulate an understanding. And one of the things that you're thinking about is the process of communication. You're thinking about how to set something up that is only going to become clear in the future.
Yes.
And I told you that hypnosis is something that I study, and that if we're creating a hypnotic experience for a person, we might have them look at a candle, or we might have them close their eyes and imagine a kaleidoscope of colors. And so one of the first things in hypnosis is to capture somebody's attention. Mm-hmm. And what you've done here is to capture the attention of your audience, and you've done that through ambiguity. You're showing them something that they can't possibly understand that becomes fascinating. And ambiguity can be a principle about how to create emotional impact. You don't have to be concrete. You don't have to be clear. You show something ambiguous, and it captures people's attention. It gets them wondering expectantly what is about to come next.
Yes. A very important aspect of building up attention, as far as I'm concerned, is to present images that are both captivating on their own, and in the beginning of the film, I feel as if one has a grace period where the audience will go with you no matter where you go. And as long as there is a steady progression of new information being presented that is only comprehensible and informed by what has come before. And I think there's great, for whatever reason, visceral pleasure out of connecting these dots of what was incomprehensible in the beginning with, oh, I see, this is what's going on. And I particularly like, in the beginning here, and we'll see it, where this rather abstract imagery turns effortlessly into a practical device of an eye scanner for security. So
that was a seamless transition.
Yeah, and I just really wanted to make it so that now that we've established pay attention to more than just what's happening on the first level. Think about, you know, what's going inside Hallie's head. And I think it helps us pay more attention to the details of Hallie's performance in the scene with the senator and all the way through, because I'm a big proponent of not first person, but a focus on a single individual's psyche as the leading force throughout a movie.
Okay. So now you're thinking about responsiveness. You're thinking about how the audience is going to respond. It's like, you set up a vibration, and you want your audience to be in synchrony with that energy that you're sending out. And now you're also thinking about process, how you're going to create some dots and you're going to elicit from the audience the energy to connect those dots. And that's an important principle of emotional impact that people don't necessarily understand, because people want to explain and explain and explain, but this idea of creating the dots and then allowing the person to energize,
yes,
by connecting the dots is really meaningful. Now, the other thing is that you're thinking really deeply into the core of the movie, and you're setting something up that is not going to become apparent to your audience for an hour at least,
yeah,
or into the movie. Now, was that something that you pre-planned?
Not necessarily that they wouldn't get it an hour into the movie. My thought was that individual audience members would get clued in at some point, some earlier than others,
uh-huh,
because I think that these clues are planted intermittently, and hopefully each time it's expanding on your understanding,
yes,
of it, so that the actual storytelling is informing what shaped her psychology at the moment as an adult. And then a lot of things begin to make sense. I am just very much interested in the psyche as a mystery foreign land that needs to be explored. And I think the best way to get people involved in this exploration is to promise them that they're going to discover something that they didn't know in the beginning of the film. So it's, and it's part the ideas itself, but it's part of what I call eye candy in the best sense of the word, mm-hmm, where there is are just visual images that are more arresting than other images. And so that's where I feel like the art of the cinema comes in, where we're using primarily a visual medium to elicit responses from people. So I love when somebody is talking on the first level about some facts, but the real story is happening in between their words and in the subtext. That's where I think the action is.
Right. And this is subliminal influence, really. You're creating a level of influence. We understand when we look at communication that there's a content, what is being communicated, and there's also a psychological level.
Mm.
And that what we say on the content level, it's really a beautiful day, or, you know, isn't that a wonderful car, means something different on the psychological level, also dependent on context. Well, you're doing psychological level communication. You're trying to impact people on a different level.
Yes.
And you're building this, and now you've added music.
Mm-hmm.
And this music makes things multiple level.
Yes.
And the music that you've added is edgy. Mm-hmm. We know that we're not going to a Disney movie. We're not going to feel light and happy after we leave this movie. It's edgy music.
Yeah.
I want to come back to one earlier piece that we didn't quite see, which is that the screen is black.
Mm-hmm.
And then suddenly the music comes on. And there's a little dissociation between the music and the picture. And you're creating a little bit of tension.
Yes.
Micro amounts of tension by destabilizing, where the picture that you see is not in synchrony with what is happening on the screen.
Yes.
And
very important to me, because I think that music can be the, in some ways, the most direct hallway down into the subconscious, unconscious, whichever you want to call it.
Uh-huh.
And it is another cue that pay attention, because something else is going on more than what's happening on the surface. And you can, in this particular movie, Halle Berry acts on the surface as a very accomplished, together woman, and it's only slowly that we find out that she's much more complicated, and what's been going on all has a reason. It is all based on childhood formative experiences.
Trauma.
Yeah,
the trauma.
Trauma
that she experienced continues to guide her life. And
yes.
You're helping us to understand some of the formative influences in early life that determine
yes.
who we are in the world.
Exactly. And I am most interested in the idea that people who have suffered trauma as in very young years is not necessarily apparent in a superficial interaction. They could be very well put together and very well spoken, and they've developed over the years a neurosis, which to me means a way of coping with that trauma and putting it in a place so that they can function, but it never really is resolved. So in a sense, I see the whole movie as a way for Halle to resolve her trauma, to be free of it, because she's a slave to it.
And that's the through line of the movie, and she doesn't do that.
Right.
And this becomes a tragedy rather than a heroic drama.
Yes.
Of somebody facing their fatal flaw, surmounting it, and being the better for it. Unfortunately, she gets bitten by her fatal flaw.
Yes.
And goes into a spiral that doesn't wind up too well for her.
Right.
Okay. Now, when we're looking at the eye here, mm-hmm. we are not looking at what an ophthalmologist will see. You colored this.
Yes.
So this is hyper-reality.
Yes.
And you're creating a moment of hyper-reality that also has emotional impact. Mm-hmm. If you just showed the inside of an eye as it is,
yeah.
and the way that you light that inside of the eye, and the lighting keeps on moving. So the movement further fixes our attention, further gets us involved, what's going on here, and creates a desire in us to understand, where is this going?
Yeah. Yeah, and I'm very much a proponent of film more akin or heavily influenced by the language of dreams, and where anything is possible and anything is any color, and it in the dream is connected to called first level reality events. There's people we recognize in dreams doing very unrecognizable things, at least unrecognizable without being analyzed. And so I feel making a film that it's a lot of fun to play with the tension between what is real to normal human, the normal human eye on the surface, and play with that and to twist it to such a degree that it's intensified. So again, it's not just, we're not looking at a medical thriller where we're going to then operate on somebody's eye, but to make the eye, you know, more of, especially when we don't know what it is, an abstract expression of the chaotic nerve synapses inside Hallie's mind.
Right.
And that's deep inside. And so as we come out, it becomes more and more recognizable, more and more normal. So by the time Hallie comes on screen, seems to be nothing amiss.
Right.
But we've been warned, and the music has helped us, and the music will carry us through, that to never forget that we're operating in something much deeper than we're watching in the first-person narrative.
So there's a strategic principle. You have a goal in mind. You're thinking about the outcome that you want to have.
Yep.
And you're building a series of successive steps on multiple levels that
yes.
get you to that outcome.
Yes.
Now, most people, when they're communicating, they don't realize that they can be thinking strategically and they can set up a series of steps. They can have an outcome in mind.
Yep.
Now, the foreshadowing, and we'll go into that in a minute, that you do. Well, I understand that when Mozart did Don Giovanni, that he wrote the overture to Don Giovanni 1 hour before it was performed.
Oh.
And the music was still wet when it was
wow.
given to the musicians. But he knew that he had to understand the overview of that movie before he could decide what the overture would be. And the overture presages strategically where he is going,
mm-hmm.
makes the audience familiar with the themes that they're going to hear.
Mm-hmm.
And you're using a similar principle here
yeah.
of creating a marker, we could call it a prime or a seed, that doesn't make sense to the audience immediately. And they're going to consciously forget about it, but on the psychological level,
yes.
you're going to be building, you're going to be building, you're going to be building, and then eventually it's going to become clear
yes.
why you put this marker in the beginning of the film.
Yeah, exactly. And hopefully it's consistent, and there are moments in Hallie's performance where I call the interstitial revelation of what's really going on in her head. And that, I think, is connected to the beginning. And without people perhaps being consciously aware of it, they're connecting the mystery of why this beginning, why this music, and then it puts into context and accentuates the subtext that's going on with Hallie, that's in her face and in her eyes and in where the camera is, whether it's a close-up or a wide shot or something else, and at what moment to cut, because a cut from a long shot to a close-up is reflective of the emotional transition going on within the character that you're cutting to.
Uh-huh.
You know, something has intensified,
uh-huh.
and I want the audience to go along and identify with the emotional roller coaster that the main character is going on.
Fantastic. So you're thinking mm-hmm. at a very refined level and very precise level about how you're creating impact and how the audience is going to resonate and how you're going to build their response. This example of foreshadowing is the best foreshadowing that I've ever seen in a movie.
Mm.
And it was ingenious, the way that you started with the abstract images, you colored them, you made them hyper-real, you segue seamlessly into an ophthalmologist's view of an eye. We showed a physician this, and he didn't even understand what those first images were and that they were the inside of an eye.
Oh, really?
Once we showed him the ophthalmologist's view of what an ophthalmologist would see, he understood immediately.
Yeah.
Now there you establish a clue. The audience now knows the clue around which this denouement is going to happen. Everything is going to pivot on that image of the ophthalmologist's view of the eye.
Right.
But the audience doesn't know that they're getting the clue that can solve the mystery.
Right.
And it can't be conscious to them.
Right.
So only on some subterranean level is the audience going to begin to understand, if ever, because you might have to watch this movie a couple of times to be to understand the incredible microdynamics of what you've done to put this together
yeah.
and make it flow so seamlessly.
Yeah, and I would add to that just, again, the fact that it's an eye is important, but You said hyperreal, and that's very important to me, that it's something, yes, it's realistic, it is actually the inside of an eye, but it's visually arresting on its own without any context, that I think people just are naturally drawn to, they're drawn to color and movement. Uh-huh. And I think you've got their attention right from the get-go, and then as it evolves, there's a kind of a minor aha experience. Uh-huh. I get this. And I don't think it can be dismissed. It can be forgotten about by the audience temporarily, uh-huh. but I think it stays in there for when the audience is watching the rest of the film. It's a seed that's planted that hopefully grows into, by the end, you go, I get it.
Let's go on and take a look at another piece. So keeping the movement going, and keeping the movement going is important because you need to keep people's eyes moving. Mm-hmm. And then you're, moving things away. And then this idea of moving the lighting from left to right.
Yes.
If you're moving the movement from left to right is usually interpreted as going away.
Yes. Yes, and we're getting distant from what I think of as one world, the internal world of the unconscious and the external presentation that we give to each other.
That is another thing that you do. What you do here with the title treatment, this is not normal title treatment. Normal title treatment is you'd have bigger titles, you'd have more people who were named in the title
yeah.
treatment. And so you're springing directly into action. You're moving the audience's attention away from something that would be normally familiar to them, have more exposition of the titles and
right.
the people who are involved in the movie.
Right.
And so by minimizing, you engage people in the action. And that's a principle that can be used in communication. I know that sometimes when I'm talking to somebody, I'm doing a hypnotic induction with a patient, and I say, you can really feel comfortable. And then I'm actually lowering my voice, minimizing an aspect of voice to make something stand out. You can make something stand out by minimizing. You can make something stand out in a whole number of different ways. What were you thinking about when you minimized the titles, were you?
Yes, very much so, that I feel as if there's a habit among moviegoers, because they've been watching it for that long, that there's going to be this title sequence, and you don't really need to pay attention. You don't know anyone's name except for the stars. And it's just a convention, and then it settles in, and then the movie begins. So you've got, as far as I'm concerned, a much less dynamic introduction into the world of the movie, and I just want to, as soon as possible, slap people right into that world of the movie with as little conventional expectation as possible. And it is about impact. It is about not what you expect. It's coming a little bit faster than you are expecting, and people will maybe stop the rhythmic motion of the popcorn and pay attention a little bit more from that. And
so by disrupting habitual pattern, you get
by disrupting their expectations, I think they pay more attention to, uh-huh. to what's going on, because they're afraid they're going to miss something. And the best part of a movie, I remember the very first movie I made.
Reckless?
Yes, Reckless. And at the screening, test screening, somebody dared to get up in the middle of the movie to go to the restroom, and I was just appalled. It's like, what do you mean? We labored over this for every single frame. How could you go away for 5 minutes? So I definitely am of the school where there isn't a frame to waste, that the compression of information and emotion, well, the compression of information and that could be used as a trigger for emotional expansion through the movie is very important. It's like the less labor you need to go through to access an unconscious understanding or a subtextual understanding, then the easier it's going to be to enter that world, rather than having to stop and say, now we're going to show you the backstory of, you know, why and everything before you know anything else. And then the mystery is solved and you're just watching the playing out of the inevitable. In this case, I wanted to see a story being played out, which is a viable story of her being a reporter and stuff, but to then reveal that the real interest is in why she's doing what she's doing, why she's made these decisions. And I'm a big advocate that, you know, people fall into jobs if they can, and I'm an American and growing up in the 50s and feeling as if you seek out the job you want, and that's a middle class American concept, I suppose, but it does reveal what it is that you're drawn to. And I think if you have your choice, then you're drawn to whatever is going to protect your trauma. And we all have traumas on some level. And the goal for me of adult therapy is to remove those protective devices and to let the organic development of the self proceed and be more authentic.
And if you do that, you're a winner. And
yeah.
You've overcome your black beast.
Right.
Let's go back to two things. One thing is the incredible precision. Your precision, frame by frame, as you said, empowers the communication. If you really want to empower communication, be precise. I told you I studied with Milton Erickson, who was the most precise therapeutic communicator who ever existed. And so all of the words, they were chosen surgically. All of the movements, they were chosen surgically. The implication of the words, chosen surgically. Mm-hmm. The implication of the gestures, chosen surgically. The effect of that was, when I was with Milton Erickson, I never felt so loved in my life. Mm. And it wasn't just me. This was who he was. Mm-hmm. But he was working so hard to be precise. If I'm really at my best doing therapy, I might get to a precision level, maybe 70%, and that would be really at my best. Now, I aspire to more, because I think precision is such an important principle and impact. Yeah. And it's like a poet. You don't have extraneous words.
Right.
You're squeezing out all of the excess. And the cuts of the movie, they squeeze out all of the excess and they give you pure emotion. And you're thinking about the precision because you know the principle that precision increases impact.
Yes. Yeah. I very much believe that. I very much believe there should not be one excess frame. And because there is something powerful about precision, as you say, and if you want to keep focused on the through line of revelation of character, then you've got to stay on message. And there's one or two places in the film that are, for me, compromised by powers that be. Small things, but are off message. And I fought bitterly to get rid of them, because I just don't think this is a whole another discussion about the movie industry, but it is unfortunately being controlled by people with money who are mostly Harvard Business School graduates, mm-hmm. and they're looking for people-pleasing moments, right. You know, and I can remember speaking to somebody about, you know, they're trying to get me to cut something out, and I said, but, you know, the subtext of what's going on, and somebody actually said to me, what do you mean exactly by subtext? Gotcha. This is somebody making movies, yeah. And I just thought, mm-hmm. I don't know where to begin, just try what subtext is. So I definitely think efficiency and compression, and I tried to apply it in the script stage and in the shooting stage, and it becomes most important in the editing stage where you are literally surgically cutting out every inch of fat you possibly can so that you're really honing in with the most precise laser beam of a narrative.
And you're honing in on emotion. You're cutting out the material that doesn't have to do with emotion.
Yes.
So what we get as viewers of a movie is we get condensed emotion.
Yes.
And we can resonate with that condensed emotion. It's like, oh, let's go to the spa, to the health club to exercise. Well, let's go to a movie. We'll exercise our emotions.
Yes.
And
yes.
We will get emotional exercise. There's one more thing I want to pick up on, which is this jump into action. Mm-hmm. When Melville wrote Moby Dick, he spends 400 pages before you get to the action scene. He's mm-hmm. setting up the context and all of the descriptive material. When Tolstoy did Anna Karenina, he jumped into action, right? Hundreds of pages later, you find out that Count Vronsky's bald, but you don't get descriptive material. And that idea of Tolstoy was really novel among writers, that he would jump into action. Mm-hmm. And what you have done here is use that principle, jump into action. And I know that when I'm doing psychotherapy, in traditional psychotherapy setting, you're spending a lot of time, you're talking about the history, and you're getting tests done, and you're learning about these things. And that's not what I do. So Erickson, my mentor, mm-hmm. when you sat down with him, he would start with hypnosis. And he would immediately jump into action. Because that has impact. And it's not spending time talking about it. Mm. It's spending time, how are you going to have an experience that helps you to cut loose, for example, of those trauma, and immediately move forward and empower yourself rather than being a slave to the ghost of Christmas past.
Yeah, that's a very attractive concept to me. Very attractive, because I just really feel as if in my own therapy there's moments where there's a lot of intellectual understanding of the dynamics, but it doesn't change anything. But when there's a spontaneous emotional connection to something, then all of a sudden I leave a session and I feel like a changed person. I feel like nerve synapses have been moved for the better and clutter has been removed. But it's interesting how intellectual understanding of dynamics doesn't necessarily precipitate change.
Two streams. This is about information. Well, if you need information, you need information to learn physics. You need information to learn mathematics. This is about experience. In the kind of approach that I use, the dynamic experiences precede the dynamic understandings. So the dynamic understandings are the dessert. The dynamic experiences are the main course. One of the reasons that we're doing this is to help people to understand this is the experiential world. Yeah. People's media literacy is so great that if I say to them, jump into action, and I show them a movie where you jump into action, suddenly they get it because of their media literacy. Now, if I just lecture to them and I say a principle of emotional impact is jump into action,
it goes right past them.
They don't get it. But because of media literacy, I show it to them. Oh, yeah. Got it. And then they have that little aha moment. They get that little epiphany, and it changes their brain cells, and then they start to be able to use that rather than be a slave to tradition. You weren't a slave to tradition in the way that you did the title treatment. You moved into a different area, and you created a little destabilization that broke a habitual pattern. It was brilliant.
Yeah. Yeah. And when I think about it, as I think about myself and think about these choices, which were not made intellectually so much as I feel now and thinking about it, reflecting on it, that it's a yearning of myself, of my own personal journey and my own personal growth and my own personal efforts to slay the beast of the past. And I think in a way, through the movies, I've been making movies unashamedly for an audience of one.
Yes.
That would get me kicked out of Hollywood tomorrow, but it's the way, because I don't know what's in the mind or the yearnings of somebody in Iowa, but I know what I figure myself a pretty close cousin to regular humans, and there's some others out there who would understand, and I think I yearn for emotional impact myself.
Right.
And so when I'm creating these things, they're coming from somewhere. They're not random. And they're coming from a need and a desire. And I think that everything that we do is in an effort to either protect ourselves or to grow.
Or to heal old wounds.
Yes, to heal our wounds. And I find it in film, you know, what is it that I crave after? And when we talk about going directly into action and or even information that I don't quite understand, it is symbolic to me as I reflect on it about facing fears, you know, that I might have in order to protect myself, a reluctance to go to a party where I don't know anybody. But it can be the most invigorating thing because it conjures up so much emotion that if I know that if I, like in between films and in this house for day after day, I get into a state of mind that's quite dormant. Mm-hmm. But all I got to do is, you know, run for 5 miles and everything changes because there's just some loosening of the status quo. And I think the status quo is a real drag on change, obviously.
So break out of the mold.
Yeah,
do things different. Just do something different.
Yes.
And you break out of the mold.
Yes.
Uh-huh. And we're all slave to habit and slave to being functionally fixed on some of the things that molded us, doesn't allow us to be who we really are capable.
Exactly. And it's driven in my own self too much by avoidance of anxiety.
Uh-huh.
And my goal is to deconstruct what it is that is causing this anxiety when I can intellectually look around and say there is no rational reason for anxiety, so it must be coming from someplace else. It must be coming from some irrational, unconscious, or buried problem. But I'm very much intrigued by your idea of first almost precipitating a breakup of the defenses,
right?
You know, so by emotional impact, which will do it.
A destabilization
of the status quo, which is built up over the years to protect yourself and to present because everybody wants to present themselves as a healthy adult with no ghosts in their closets or anything else, but then, of course, we find out that it's all a big parade of posing for an awful lot of people.
So one of the things that you're doing, and it's true of me and my occupation, your marital choice could be a search for healing. Well, your occupation can be a search for healing too.
Oh, absolutely.
And I go into my occupation, I want to heal myself. You get the opportunity to heal yourself, explore these psychological themes, and yes, you can make the movie just for yourself, and it's perfectly okay.
Yeah, I mean, to me it is, and I feel really tend to look at life sometimes in real macro movements, including evolutionary movements and everything else. And I feel, because I was going to be a shrink when I was an undergraduate and go to medical school and all that, and then I took a course at NYU just for fun, making a movie, and we had 1 minute. We had to make a 1 minute movie on 16mm no sound. And we had like 4 hours, so I closest place was Washington Square Park, so I just went over there and I filmed children playing in the sandlot, and I got down on their level. And I was just shooting them, and I don't know what the hell I was doing, but into the frame came two clearly adult male legs and hands, then a man's hands coming up and picking up a little child and taking them out of the film, and the audience of students, about 20 students in unison, went Now I was 20 or something and had never felt that feeling before, that something I had done
had
that other 20 strangers reacted in unison to, and I thought, my God, it can do that. And I really, without trying to be cute, felt like I had discovered an previously unknown organ inside of me that could be stimulated.
It's a great moment.
You know, it's a great moment, and it's on the par with sexual desire and appetite for food.
Right.
You know, and it changed me forever. And I just said, like eating or having sex, the first thing you think about is how can I do that again?
Yeah. I would call that a defining moment. And like, there's a defining moment where you know you're a movie maker, a defining moment where I know that I'm a psychologist, a defining moment where you know you're a man, a defining moment when you know that you're a woman, a defining moment when you know that you're funny. These are defining moments.
Yeah.
And part of the reason for creating emotional impact is that you can't create those defining moments intellectually.
Yeah.
The moments that define us are moments of emotional impact.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I'm doing in my work is to try to use my therapy room as a symbol drama of change. I enact a symbolic drama in which the person can suddenly empower themselves into that defining moment. And by the way, I model you, and I see you as a source of excellence, and I try to model the precision that you use, the breaking out of habits that you use, the setting things up strategically to create those defining moments where suddenly people can let loose of an old pattern or an old identity and move themselves discreetly forward into being more of who they were destined
to be. Right. It makes eminent sense. Eminent sense. And I'm beginning to have my own transition about the emotional impact of my own movies, which I, there's a kind of a hurdle to get over to let your own movie come back to you and influence you as much as one would like, because it's come from you, so you're cheated out of the pure, unknown revelation of what's going on, so the emotional impact is dulled, and which is why I'm a movie fanatic and want to see everybody else's movies.
So that you can feel that process.
Yeah.
Now, we've used this movie as a talking point. We have gotten maybe 1 minute into the movie, and this has been a wide-ranging talk about the components of that movie, the components of what you do that can be translated into our emotional lives, into the emotional lives of other people, and how they can start to see art, especially movies in this case, in a different way, begin to extract some of those things, take them into their daily life, and improve their daily life, even heal some old wounds. Let's take a look a little bit further. Sure. I'd like to see if we could get through the first 5 minutes. Yeah. I don't know if we'll do it, but let's take a try. Okay. Now that's shocking.
Mm.
When you have the sound and the exaggerated sound.
Yes.
Because that's
purposely
not what we would
know.
Purposely exaggerated sound. So by exaggeration, you fix our attention, you suddenly startle us, and
yes.
I imagine the 200 people in the theater blink at that moment and pull back.
Yes, because it's something new being introduced, and it begins to contextualize our transition into first-level reality. But I want them to see that. I want them to see, because I think that could be, I don't even know, the first time somebody thinks, okay, this is an I. And I want to just make that gradual transition into it being Hallie's eye. But I'm a big proponent of not creating artificial connections between scenes in a movie. It's not a fantastical movie. It's psychological realism. And I think the movie has to yield to that decision. And so suddenly you can't go off in, there has to be a discipline of consistency of that psychological realism, which goes along with movie making realism, which there are other movies which I enjoy very much, big, gigantic Avatar-type movies, which are highly enjoyable but are not focused on grounding it in psychological realism necessarily. And so there's no invitation to the interior of that. And in that kind of movie, since you're not grounded in psychological realism, you can go wherever you want. You can go to different planets, you can go to the future, which I think you can do because it's realistic to go to a different planet at some point. But still, it's not the event of going to the planet that I think is most interesting to an audience. I think it's the empathy and identification with the human who is going there and what they're experiencing. You know, I still think that it's quite obvious the human mind is the least explored aspect of nature that, you know, and when I'm so glad to hear that the effort to return to the moon has been canceled because I just could not figure out for the life of me why it was important to spend limited resources returning to the moon to get some more rocks. Mm-hmm. And I'd much rather see the money go into
more inner space.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Let's move forward. Now, even this moment here, where you have an extreme close-up of Halle Berry, you are showing emotion. Any emotion that she's experiencing is going to really be predominant in the mind of the viewer because you're showing the emotional center that people respond to, which is a close-up of the face.
Right.
Now, you're lighting the right side of her face. I don't know if that happens by accident or not.
No.
And you're showing more of the left side of her face.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
mm-hmm.
because people's emotional center is more in their right hemisphere, more emotion is normally expressed on the left side of your face. So if I'm looking at you, I'm scanning more to the left side of your face because your emotion's generated out of your right hemisphere. I'm going to unconsciously be attending to the right side of your face. And if you look at your own musculature in the mirror, and you're thinking that you're more of a right hemisphere person, then probably when you look at your musculature, you're going to see more well-developed musculature on the left side of your face because you're using your right hemisphere more. Now, if you had a rocket scientist who was using his left hemisphere more, you would probably notice more wrinkles, more musculature on the right side of his face because he was using his left hemisphere more.
Yeah.
I know that in Glengarry Glen Ross, you illuminated the left side of Pacino's face.
Mm-hmm.
And you didn't want to show the right side of his
mm-hmm.
face.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, at what level, I know at what level I'm trying to hope that you're thinking about, but I'm giving you credit for thinking at a pretty refined...
Maybe not as refined, but an instinctual sense of the... probably a simpler idea of the duplicity of what he was saying and how he was presenting himself. And I think Ricky Roma is just the most monstrous creation that's come out of a writer's mind. And brilliantly understood and acted by Al Pacino.
So
and he understood that. And I particularly remember when he's trying to convince Jonathan Pryce not to renege on the deal.
Mm-hmm.
He's trying to seduce him, which has sexual overtones, which has all sorts of overtones. But his face is split, is in lighting, you know, because we know that he's trying to present one side to Jonathan Pryce, but a truthful side, if you look closely, is lit differently, and it's his mechanical invention of how he is presenting this disingenuous seduction,
uh-huh.
Which is one big lie.
Right.
And so I like, you know, ambiguity, I think, is the hallmark of what fascinates me the most. That
uh-huh.
they're just, and what infuriates me the most about a good deal of Hollywood movies, that there are simplistic good guys and bad guys and resolution, and it just is not my experience in life that
right.
that's how it goes. Not my experience in my internal life or my external life with other people.
Right.
It just doesn't work out that way. It's
so
a
the
billion
psychological
times
realism
more.
Is let's not create cartoon characters. Let's show the complexity of human
yes,
behavior.
Yes, which includes good and evil and includes almost every decision
motives
somebody
and,
makes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and motives and
yeah.
very important.
So there's another piece that I want you to look at here. And this is that you interpose in between the camera and the protagonist objects.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is not a scene that anybody will see in real life in the way that it shows up on the screen.
Right.
And when you interpose those objects, this is a kind of discontinuity, a kind of destabilization in itself, in a real... you know, James Bond action movie, you might have objects in between the camera and the protagonist that happen 100 times in the movie. The viewer yeah. never sees that.
Yes.
But you're doing that because you're creating micro moments of arousal.
Yes. Yes. And in this case, it's serving two purposes, which I love, that the storytelling and the first level storytelling and the subtextual storytelling come together in the right way. And I wanted to get into the reality of where she was. And so this monitor identifying her as a visitor gives us more information grounded in the first level of where she is and what she's doing, which gets slowly revealed. And so it worked out well that this information would be between what I call the first level world, where the security officer is looking at it and everything, and its information, and it's also working on a graphic subtext level where there is separation between Hallie and the real world, in a sense. And that is something that I love playing with, because she's so good as a character.
Uh-huh.
Forget about Hallie for a second, but so good as a character at playing a character.
Mm-hmm.
And so I like setting up her as seemingly neurosis-free as possible uh-huh. in the beginning, and then slowly, right. you know, reveal that there's a monster inside there.
So we're slowly, strategically developing the story, and so that the person becomes involved in it, and then we understand that she is a really complex creature,
yes.
and that she doesn't know her own identity.
Yes.
And she has what we would call in the psychiatric trade an identity diffusion. Mm-hmm. And so Perfect Stranger is a very good title because she's somewhat of a stranger to herself.
Yes, that's me.
Not understanding the dynamic forces, psychodynamic yes. forces that guide her.
Yes.
And so you presage some of that in the way in which you set up the shots or set up particular scenes in the movie. It's just brilliant, I think. And then you have these objects.
Yeah, yeah. I love those objects, and I love her moving through what are ultimately scanners. They're scanning everything, trying to see inside her, and they're not really revealing anything other than objects and stuff, but it continues the practice of trying to really x-ray, which is the whole movie, is to x-ray Hallie's character and see what is ticking there, and for the x-ray to take over from the first level of reality and vision. And even this brief quasi-flirtation with this guy is meant to ground her in a familiar interaction, normal, that would happen with a woman so pretty and a guy wanting to take a half a second to flirt with her.
Sure.
And she responds to it, and it's a man, and she's comfortable with it, and she can go on like that. But as we'll see what's coming up, she has a different approach to what she's doing with the man.
Without understanding why it is that she's acting in the way that she is.
Exactly.
She's a slave to her own psychodynamic forces.
Perfect sentence. She is a slave to her own, which I think we all are to some degree, and that's the goal, is to liberate ourselves from, was it Freud's phrase, the dark hand of the past, or whatever that is. And she's trying to do it in a way that is perhaps not the most effective.
To say the least. Okay, now let's talk about the cuts for a moment, because there's like, in this next sequence, it's like a fraction of a second cut. Mm-hmm. Now, that, where you cut slow to the guard, and it's just so quick.
Yeah.
And you don't allow the audience to rest. And these cuts, again, they take out any of the extraneous material. They make the emotion pure protein. It's like condensed soup.
Yep.
So you're looking for emotional moments, you're emphasizing those emotional moments, and the viewer gets the power of unadulterated emotion. And there's very few media where we get the power of unadulterated emotion.
Yeah.
But I still think that in everyday communication or in the therapy that I do, we can emphasize more of the emotion and cut out some of the extraneous material if we want to help people to make these defining moments and overcome some of the tragedies of the past.
Yeah. I'm very curious about what you're saying about how resistance plays a part in getting people to write to the emotional core, whether it, I don't understand hypnosis very well, but I would think that there would be some kind of resistance to holding back. Or is that not so much the case?
Oh, there is. I mean, familiarity is such a great motivator that people keep on doing what's familiar even though it's not effective.
Yeah.
And so there's an inertia that's just a normal kind of resistance to change because we opt for familiarity even though it's not effective in the world.
Yeah.
Okay.
Exactly.
So, but then when you're using these cuts, you use more cuts when you want the viewer to feel more emotion.
Yes.
You just increase the frequency of cuts and we feel more tension.
Yes.
We don't realize that.
Yeah.
The average cut in a movie is about 8 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
In a 1.5 hour movie, you could have 500 cuts.
Mm-hmm.
The viewer leaves the movie theater and has no idea that he's seen one cut.
Yeah, yeah.
But in another,
I like that.
In another movie, where in Confidence, which is more like you won't... It's not a movie that necessarily takes itself seriously as a psychological thriller.
Right.
And suddenly in Confidence, you're using shh, and you're using obvious cuts. And that gives the person a feeling that they don't have to take this quite so
right.
seriously.
Right.
It can
exactly.
be a role.
It's a ride, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and it's very important because this is all about internal subtext, whereas... Confidence was something I very much wanted to do as a palate cleanser,
uh-huh.
you know, to just have characters which I like. Well, you know, to make a comedy, which for me is a comedy, with external surprises and switches, and but it's definitely. The best word is a palate cleanser. I really believe in that in order to clear my mind, learn something new so I can go back to my central interest and be, because I'm convinced that, you know, I learn a tremendous amount on every movie,
mm-hmm.
and whether I'm conscious of it or not, I just grow more confident at my own instincts without having to intellectually validate them
uh-huh.
and get through the day a lot easier.
Now, I don't have any problem if I'm working with somebody and suddenly I make a sound and do an unusual gesture as a moment of destabilization before I come to a dramatic point.
Right.
And, you know, it just goes past people. It's not that it stands out to them
right.
as he just went shh, and like the cut in a movie, he just, you know, changed the tone for a second by adding a little microscopic dose of
yeah.
Of tension that is like a spice that makes the stew much more robust and rich.
Yes.
And I use sound effects when I'm, you know, doing therapy. And
oh, really?
I use ambiguities. You have a technique in movie making of pars pro toto. You show a part that represents the whole. If you want mm-hmm. somebody to think about sex, you show them a bed. If you want them to think about illness, you show them a hospital drip.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to show everything. The part represents the whole.
Mm-hmm.
And so in a psychotherapy situation, if I'm talking with somebody about... I want you to be in integrity with yourself. And suddenly I'm making a gesture.
Mm-hmm.
And this gesture starts to become, well, kind of an anchor for getting into this state of being in integrity with yourself, which could be you're not using drugs or you're not using alcohol or you're not gambling. But suddenly you get the idea that you don't have to go into that place. So the other day I'm doing therapy with a young boy. He's 17 years old, multiple drug user. And what was his father? Well, his father's still in treatment as a multiple drug user. So I know that this boy's trauma has to do with using drugs as an experiential understanding of his father's conundrum that was never solved.
Mm-hmm.
And so now I'm creating a moment where I'm just visualizing in space and I'm saying, okay, here are the things that you do. Actually, it was, here are the things that you do and here are the things that you don't do.
Right.
And so stealing may be something that you don't do. Homosexuality for, you know, is great for some people, but here's something that you don't do.
Right.
This is in the bucket of things that you don't do. And gradually, I'm easing him strategically, dramatically, into the idea that he is going to take his addiction and he's going to put his addiction in that bucket of things that he doesn't do.
Mm.
But I'm just using representations and ambiguities. And because I really want to have emotional impact with him, and suddenly you see, aha, he got it. And I didn't have yeah. to lead him there.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
But you're doing some of the same technique. You're just creating these little dots and you're not connecting the dots, you're allowing the audience connect the dots.
Yeah.
This should be a principle of dramatic communication.
Yeah.
Don't connect the dots, create them.
They have to connect the dots themselves, you know, individually. It has to come together. You know, to have the dots explained to them is one thing, but to have them experience them on their own, even when their person they came to the movie with doesn't know what the hell is going on, it doesn't matter. The individual watching it is picking up on the cues. And I don't think people have to be trained to watch a movie and to get the most out of it. I just think it's... has to be presented in the right light, and it has to be contextualized before you see it about the kind of thing. Because I think there's a very heavy influence when somebody explains to you what a movie's about, and then it turns out to be nothing about that.
Mm-hmm.
This creates a dissonance and a bit of an anger, I think. And I had that experience recently, and on the film The White Ribbon, I don't know if you've seen that, but it's a pre-World War I film, and I'm a real buff about stuff like that, and I expected to be in Berlin and all sorts of big action and government things and troops in the streets and things like that, and instead it all took place in a very tiny village, and it was very metaphorical. And I was just totally turned off by it.
Mm-hmm.
Until then, afterwards, people I was seeing it with loved it and started talking about it and talking about how it... And then I went back and I watched it again, and I fell in love with it,
uh-huh.
You know, because I was prepared to know what I was going into. And I think that is an important aspect of it.
Well, I don't see how... You know, people go to a movie, they watch the movie once, they've had it.
Yep.
But when we look, and we're just looking at the first 3 minutes so far of your movie as this talking point, and to deconstruct that and to understand what you're doing and how precise you're being and how thoughtful you're being about influence, that unless they really watch the movie two or three times, they miss the subtlety.
Yeah.
But it doesn't stop you because you're, by the way, putting a psychological level communication and making that so subtle that gradually there's got to be a build-up of impact, as if it's filling a reservoir that eventually spills over into some experiential understanding. There's another principle of emotional impact that I wanted to talk with you about, which is a principle of cohesion. In some of your movies, I think you're using the same lighting person because you have some themes in your lighting that create cohesion on an unconscious level. Like in Glengarry Glen Ross, you have a lot of red and you have a lot of blue, I think, and a lot of green in the lighting pattern. Now, this lighting pattern goes across scenes, and nobody is going to realize that you're using a hyper-reality in your lighting. Yeah. That's not something you see. Or in Confidence, when I forgot the name of the two principal actors, when
they're Edward Burns and Rachel Weisz,
right, and they're in the bar, and you have one of them lit up in blue light and one of them lit up in red light, and it creates this moment of hyper-reality, and we don't even as viewers realize what you're doing about creating more emotion with hyper-reality, but then the theme cohesively moves itself across the different sets where you have the same kind of lighting, and we don't even realize that.
Right,
but you have to be thinking that one of the things you want to do is to create cohesion.
Yep.
And I know that if Beethoven was creating a symphony, that cohesion is really important, and you have a theme and a tone, and you return to that theme, and you return to that tone, and then over the course of the symphony, you don't realize that you're being influenced by cohesive elements that show up in unrelated places.
Yeah, and what's interesting is that so much, I mean, there's a phrase that on the day before you start production of the movie, 90% of the movie has been decided and has been made, because in pre-production, all the decisions you made about the cinematographer, about the lighting scheme, about the casting, about the locations, they've all been decided and they're kind of set in stone. So you're just going and you're executing them. And I remember in Confidence, I wanted, because it had crypto-noirish connections, and I wanted to sort of go against that and have the what I wanted, ideally, our budget didn't allow us too much of it, but, you know, L.A. at magic hour, you know, when the sun is down, but it's the sky still bright, that's what I wanted, because when I walked along Sunset and saw the neon in that light, it really excited me, and I wanted to see Los Angeles as a place where there was a kind of underground of these guys, but it was a lot of contradictions, which frankly amused me. You know, that Ed Burns and Rachel Weisz were beautiful, and and the sidekicks were funny, and no one really gets hurt, no one gets burned, as you know, bad guys get some money ripped off. But I like contradicting convention, and when people start talking to me about genre, I go blank, because I never think of genre that I'm working in, because I, for me, unless I think about it more or read something about it, I don't see the efficacy of being aware of what genre you're working in, because you're only then feel constrained to stay within boundaries of, and there was a recent review of a new Jim Thompson movie that, you know, was complaining that it didn't have the certain elements of the great noir movies of the 40s and 50s. Well, why should it? And who said it's film noir? Who invented the term film noir? And why should anyone stick to it? I mean, I think genre is just limiting.
So thinking about those moments in which convention is not going to serve you well, which convention becomes a frame that becomes a box that keeps you within certain parameters,
and
how can we break out of convention?
Yeah, and the only good thing about that convention is that there is an audience expectation of that convention. So when you break it, you create a certain impact. Mm-hmm. You create a certain interest level of it's not what you expect, and that piques your interest to see what is going to come. So I'm all anti-genre.
Let's take a look at just a couple of more sections and finish this out. Now that's a great moment of precision where you put the R on his...
Not an accident.
Not an accident. Couldn't be an accident. Right.
No.
And so this orients us subliminally to what it is that we're going to encounter about traditional values.
Yes. Yes. Mm-hmm. And I like the juxtaposition of when she just went through there and that guy made the flirtation. And she was very comfortable with it. She said, you know, it was a security blanket, blah, 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 and smiled and went on. It was perfectly appropriate. But she's going in now like a vicious tigress.
Yes.
You know,
so.
And an
stalking
attack.
Stalking the prey.
And he's stalking the prey, and it's an attack against a man with a false identity.
A hypocrite.
And somebody presenting something to the world that he's not. And worse than that, you know, promoting the very things that he is not organic to himself. And that, to me, is one of the saddest sort of positions to be in. And she clearly takes delight in exposing the contradictions of men and their hypocrisy, and mostly to uncover. She's an investigative reporter. She wants to uncover the surface layer of powerful men and bring them down. I mean, that's the central thing. She's focused on bringing down men, and that's why she gets involved with
that. But she doesn't even understand why she's doing that.
Exactly. That's a very important thing. She doesn't. She's got a very good job, and she's very good at it because she's very motivated by it. And, you know, she's found her level of expression to do this until she's thwarted by, in a subsequent scene, about she gets very angry when the story is killed and talks about a cabal of men who are controlling things and the old boys club and all that stuff. I mean, she's clearly on a crusade to bring down men, you know, to bring down powerful men, because obviously what happened to her, the man was very powerful relative to herself.
Now, a convention here is that you put the person who is one up, who has more status,
right,
on the left,
yes,
and the person who has less status on the right.
Uh-huh.
And this partly has to do with the fact that we read from left to right. I don't,
yes,
know if you were making an Israeli movie or an Arabic movie, if you would reverse the convention. But are you thinking about that?
Not consciously, to be honest. I'm thinking more about the impact of that shot, of Hallie's first glance at him. And, I mean, I see in there the tigress, uh-huh, just below the surface.
Right.
And I wanted to give her the a kind of more... He's the senator.
Right.
She's a reporter. And... it was not by accident that we had his secretary out to lunch.
Right.
And it's not by accident that her framing is, in a way, dominant to his. And she comes into the room and she does dominate the entire scene,
right,
in a way that gives her great, at least superficial, pleasure.
We see her first as a crusading reporter, and then,
yes,
slowly we begin to understand that she's got a hidden agenda,
yes,
that drives her.
Yes.
Okay. Now, in this...
Even answer your own door, Senator. I'm impressed.
Front porch mentality. I like to know who's visiting. Plus, my secretary, Laura, just stepped out for an early lunch.
Carolyn Eldridge from Family First is visiting.
Yeah, early. I like that. Come on.
Okay, so now at this moment, this is what we could call, and I would like to know what you call it, but we could call this a clean entrance.
Mm-hmm.
So actually, if we went on one section further.
Let's take this off.
Okay.
So here you have a bird's eye view of this office, which gives you some idea of his status and his power, but we know that you're going from a clean entrance, you're going to go to a close-up next.
Yes.
If you see the... building, you know that the next shot is going to be in the office. If you see the airplane, you know that the next shot is going to be inside the airplane.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So this is part of that strategic setup,
yes,
where you would have, we'd be thinking in triplets. What's a clean entrance? What's the presentation? How am I going to back out of this?
Yes.
And so rather than thinking about communication in a way that's staccato, how will I set up? How will I intervene? How will I follow through?
Yes.
If a doctor was giving a prescription, rather than just to make that an afterthought, the doctor could make that into a dramatic intervention by setting it up, intervening, following through. If,
yes,
somebody was talking to an employee about how to be more successful in their job, they could set it up, they could intervene, they could follow through. A clean entrance would be one way of,
mm-hmm,
making,
mm-hmm,
that happen.
Mm-hmm.
What do you call that?
That's very important to me. And what's important is that, again, you know, we need, just for cinematic language, to establish the geography of the office. And but you can see in this shot, there is no focus. It becomes kind of objective. So it was very important that before we show this shot, that we have a very clean close-up of Hallie so that she can carry, we can stay with her and her psychological state as we go through this necessary shot. Because we do have to keep in mind the tension between wanting to be inside the psychological realism of people, but also to present a cogent world. Mm-hmm. And it's fascinating to me that it is, at least temporarily, a 2D world, which is totally created, and, you know, here and here and here are lights and 100 people standing around. But we have to be able to tell the first level story that is easily understandable so that we can exploit the friction between the first level and the subtext. And so that's why that close-up has to come there. And I'm not even positive what the next shot is, but I'm sure that Hallie's in it.
Yes. And the next shot is?
Hope you don't mind if I take this out. My hard drive is now officially my only source of memory. And I want to get all those old-fashioned values down accurately. Now, as you know, we're putting together...
Now, suddenly the music is gone.
Yeah.
And when the music is gone, we don't even recognize that you've stopped the music.
Yes.
And you have this moment of silence.
Yes.
Where now you've removed a level from the mix.
Yes.
So rather than having more multiple levels and increasing the complexity, you take away a level, what you're thinking.
Yeah. And very important to me that it's almost as if when she sits down and starts her rap, it's almost like, no exaggeration, a song to me that she has created and memorized and has a strategy. And it's a seductive song that I think is very well done by her.
Beautifully.
And that descends into a smack in the face to him. So, and I love that she is enjoying this, you know, at least on the surface, she's enjoying this. She's scratching an itch that she's got, and she is clearly in control of the situation and gets more and more in control of the situation until she has a senator quivering in his boots.
Right.
And this is, I think, greatly satisfying to her.
The fact that she could do that and portray this inquiring reporter on one level, and we think we're seeing this enterprising reporter, and yet on another level, we see that there's this tiger that's starting to come out that we don't understand what it's about.
Yes.
That's an incredible acting job.
Yep.
Okay, so now you're thinking about this hop, skip, and a jump. You're setting up from where you see her to putting the camera on a boom, getting this eagle eye shot, and we're going to get an eagle eye perspective on the senator, and we're going to get an eagle eye perspective on who Halle Berry really is. And it's set up with this eagle eye shot, which, by the way, seems like it's expensive. You've got to take the time to set up this shot and make it work. But for the artistic integrity and for the impact, it really works.
Right. Yeah. Yes. That's always the challenge between the technical recreation of reality. I mean, for instance, the hallway she walked down and the door she knocked on is not the door to this office. This is an entirely different location.
Uh-huh.
So it's that part of filmmaking that intrigues me too.
Uh-huh.
That it has really nothing to do with the experience of watching the movie, but it, in making it, it's putting together pieces that suit your story and your psychological focus better than the architect who designed the building, who was not thinking of that.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to pick and choose, and why location scouts are so important. And to me, is it Aristotle, people, place, person, you know, place is extremely important, and and there's the friction with money, and so there's got to be a lot of creativity in creating the actual world that you believe. Mm-hmm. And I think we did a good job in this case.
And all along, you're keeping people's eyes moving, you're keeping the energy flowing.
Yeah.
Because if you stop the movement for even a fraction, it doesn't work.
Yep.
Then putting somebody in the center of the screen, this is not something that you want to
right.
do, because the center of the screen is emotionally dead space. You want
yeah.
to keep the movement. So even when they entered into the room, you had the senator and Halle Berry on the left side of the screen,
right.
and you opened up the right side of the screen. Now, the person, again, who's viewing it, they're not paying attention to the fact that you're pushing their eyes to the left, and
yes.
you're moving their eyes
yes.
to the right,
yes.
and you're keeping the person responding.
Yes.
When I read Walter Murch's book, In the Blink of an Eye,
mm.
right, and he says that he's timing his cuts to the moment in which he wants you to blink, because a discontinuity creates a blink. If I move my head quickly, that's a discontinuity. I have to blink.
Yes.
I can't help but blink. The cuts in the movie are discontinuities.
Uh-huh.
And if you want to build the responsiveness of the people, maybe you're working on even that much of a subtle level.
Yeah.
I know that as I'm sitting here with you, if I want to create more attunement, more rapport, I'm moving my body roughly in the posture that your body is. I'm attuning myself to you. If I wanted to, I can attune my head movement to yours. I can attune my breathing rate to yours. If I really wanted to, I could attune my blink rate so that my blink rate was attuned to yours, creating this extra feeling of attunement.
Yeah.
I want
yeah.
you to like me.
Yeah.
So if I start to mirror at a very subtle level, that can create this feeling of extraordinary rapport.
Yeah, that
and
really makes sense to me.
Uh-huh.
That really makes sense and could be very useful in therapeutic situations, mm-hmm. as far as I'm concerned.
Except
it's not something I've experienced,
no,
but it's something
most therapists
deeply intriguing to me.
And what you've been doing is you've been teaching me to be a better therapist, because I've watched multiple times
mm-hmm.
10 of your movies, and I start to get into this mentality of looking and deconstructing them and trying to understand the techniques that you're using to have emotional impact. And then I say, okay, this is cheerful. I'll take them into my office,
yep.
and I'll start using them in my office. And if I want to build responsiveness, maybe I'll, you know, do some unusual movements, and I'll keep the person's eyes moving. And if I want to, create some impact, I might be talking from a side of my chair and trying to, you know, get the person to be thinking in a different way and moving in a different way and building the tension in a different way. But I think that if really simpatico and savvy communicator, they could, because I've presented this project to attorneys, for example,
mm-hmm.
how do you teach an attorney how to be more manipulative? Well, you
yeah.
can take things from movie makers and apply them into the courtroom situation.
Right.
Well, they do some of that anyway.
Yeah.
And then, but also for parents, how could you, if you want to have impact on your child, and if you wanted to think on that level of a very precise communication in order to do little things that created momentary changes in the level of tension or momentary changes in the level of arousal. So arousal in traditional hypnosis is like, you know, you're just moving the person into the soporific state. But in a more modern approach to hypnosis, it would be much more doing what you do, which is why I say that I've been informing my work in my field with what you do so brilliantly in your field,
mm-hmm.
and I now can use more tension in the simple act of creating a hypnotic induction. Let's finish with one more piece, because then here what you're going to do is you're going to increase the number of cuts. Suddenly when the senator gets caught and he stands up, the cuts increase.
Yes.
We don't realize, and the tension is going to increase.
Yes, yes. It's very, and I think of, it's something that happens in the editing room, which is, I think, a organic follow-up to this, that this is obviously filmed, not in cuts. You know, all her stuff is filmed first, and all his stuff is filmed. And so the speed of the cuts is in the back of my mind as just an organic technique of increasing tension. And when you get in the editing room, you go through stages, and you don't, and you can't, I'm convinced, just cut to the chase, because you have to find the rhythm. You have to find the, you know, you want to increase the cuts, but you're not thinking about that mechanical idea of increasing the cuts. You're following the story, and you're trying to read his emotional reactions and her emotional reactions. And since they're escalating, you know, she's going in for the kill and he's being wounded and being desperate, then the whole scene, which started out very smoothly, I think she does a brilliant job of just sliding right into whipping out the knife and stabbing it into him. Mm-hmm. And I think that's exactly, given what we find out about her history and everything, is exactly what she's motivated to do, is stick that knife in.
Yep. Now, throughout a series of scenes, we're going to come back to seeing the inside of an eye. And they, it shows up as Bruce Willis is walking through, was it G2?
His advertising agency.
His advertising agency.
Whatever it was called,
G2H or something.
Yeah.
It was like an H2O, but it was G2O or something.
Yeah.
Like that. Uh-huh. So as he's walking through, you see those, but they don't have impact to you except on some subliminal level, right, that you're building into this denouement.
Yes.
Now, part of this, and I'm maybe over-interpreting here, but let me check it out with you. So it's not just that the foreshadowing is happening on that level, but the whole movie is based on somebody seeing something.
Yes, yes, I was going to get to that, yeah.
Uh-huh, and then the final scene... Again, somebody's seeing
something.
Right. So starting with the eye is not only seeding on the level of structure, not only priming on the level of structure, it's priming on the level of content.
Yes. Yes. Very important, because you find out eventually that something that she does in order to protect a secret of her mother's is to try to eliminate eyes that have that are dangerous and that she's being blackmailed from, and so she's got to cut those eyes out, theoretically speaking. And so I think the seeing of things works on a level of bread and butter storytelling of who saw what when, mm-hmm, and it's in our seeing becomes our eyes. I think it goes back and forth, and our eyes get more attentive. So those eyes in the beginning make us conscious on some level of our own vision, and mm-hmm, it's almost a manipulator to look sharply.
Uh-huh.
And
an invitation.
I have to have a... I can't make an ensemble equal movie, because there's like a comedy of manners, or it's a drama of manners, because I never think you can't get inside the head of, I think, more than one person. If you're making one piece of art, one piece of work, you're, you know, now in confidence, we're not going in for subtext and stuff like that, so we can enjoy the surface pleasures of what's going on, and it's more entertainment. But I've always had to identify, whether it was in A Close Range or After Dark, My Sweet, with Sean Penn and Jason Patrick, and in Glengarry Glen Ross, although there is an ensemble, it is tilted towards the point of view of Al Pacino, of Ricky Romer, and his looking out over the horizon. And he's great at that, because he would be sitting there pretending to do work, And when no one else was looking at him, the other characters, he'd be glancing up. Now, this is what I love, that the audience sees something that the rest of the characters don't. So the audiences are in on something, and they're sucked in, they're involved, they're empathizing with that main character. And so and this was the first time I worked with a woman as the protagonist, mm-hmm. and couldn't have had a better experience with Hallie.
Okay. One other thing. This idea of foreshadowing, right? My mentor, Milton Erickson, when I'm going to see him, 1973, he gives me a book. The book is Nightmare Alley. There's a Tyrone Power movie of Nightmare Alley. It's about a roustabout in the carnival, and eventually he becomes a mind reader, the great Stanton, and it's a very interesting psychological expose of a psychopathic personality. But so Erickson says to me, read the first page, tell me what does it say on the last page. Now, this was my first entree into understanding foreshadowing. And so I read the first page. I'm a marriage and family counselor at the time. I'm a new therapist. I read the first page, and I have no idea. What does it say on the last page? So I say to Dr. Erickson, well, tell me, what does it say on the last page? He says, read the book. So I read the book. I get to the last page. I come back to the first page. I go to the last page. I come back to the first page. Oh, my God. If I knew how to read, if I knew how to see at that moment, I would have understood that the last page of the book was foreshadowed on the first page of the book. Yeah. Now we know in psychological research, and I mentioned to you that there's maybe 1,000 studies on priming that show that if you create an allusion to a target, you increase the possibility that that representation will be accessed.
Yes.
For example, a simple priming experiment is learning paired associates, up, down, here, there, floor, ceiling, ocean, moon, past, future. So you have to say one. If I say one, you have to say the other. Then they give the student a cup of coffee, and then they ask him to recite the paired associates again. Does the variable of adding coffee increase memory or not? Mm. Now, it seems like that's the experiment. Mm-hmm. But the actual experiment is that after the experiment, they ask, what is your favorite car? What is your favorite color? What is your favorite laundry detergent? Now, the people who are primed with ocean moon are much more likely to say Tide as their favorite laundry detergent than people who are not primed. In another priming experiment, you're doing the experiment, it's learning something, but in the back of the room, there's the faintest smell of lemon detergent. At the end of the experiment, the experimenter says, you did a great job, you did a wonderful job, here's a cookie, it's a very crumbly cracker. Independent raters look at this, and the people who are primed with the scent of lemon detergent are much more likely to clean the table than people who are not primed.
That's hilarious.
In another experiment on priming, they are learning arrays of letters. You see S-W-O-L-Z, make a word. You make the word slow. Well, people who are primed with words like slow, Florida, retired, when they walk down the hall after the experiment, they walk much more slowly than the people who are not so primed. So now there's scientific evidence that if you foreshadow something, you will increase the likelihood that that prime is responded to.
Yes, God, just resonated. That's true.
I want to know why you thought of priming at such an incredibly complex and deep level, and you knew that that was going to work. You're not familiar with the scientific research that shows undoubtedly that there's good reason to believe that that's going to work. You're not familiar with the subliminal research that goes on, but intuitively, as a storyteller, an excellent storyteller, you knew that if you primed that I, and you segued so seamlessly into that, that this was going to have emotional impact.
And why you just said to me about the experiments resonates so much is that I have been doing this unconsciously, without any academic information guiding me. Film school was how to operate the camera, which is long gone. I couldn't operate that camera. I find it the great pleasure of my life that I stumbled upon that which I should be doing. Yeah. And I think it's got to be rare throughout the species. Uh-huh. You know, most people are working for survival. Uh-huh. And so to have the opportunity to find an art form that has no limit, and that's what I love about it. Yep. Because it involves psychology and music and visuals and anything you can think of. And it also takes you to worlds that you would never go to without making the movie. And, you know, I made it close range down in real rural Appalachian poverty. Mm-hmm. That just freaked me out. And but I got into it, and I have a sense now of the country much more than I ever did when I traveled around and did things. So I do think filmmaking is, as David Mamet says, you know, the art form of the 21st century. Mm-hmm. And why he has gravitated more and more towards making films than uh-huh. writing plays. And I just feel really, really lucky that I stumbled upon something that even now my mind is expanding personally, which is the main event, frankly, right. Your own life and right. Your own mind and your own expansion of your mind. And this, it's a lyric from a song that sort of changed my life about 5 years ago, you know, misquoting, but to wake up before I die. Uh-huh. And I think you have aroused me in waking up just a little bit more.
Oh, I hope so. I hope so. You've done such a fabulous job, and you've been really an inspiration to me to learn from you, and I hope that I can offer you just a little bit something.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially, I'm going to read that book, especially in the therapy department for my own future. Mm-hmm. I want to, because I need a change of approach. I've outgrown one and need to grow into another. And it seems like you're making a whole lot of sense and on the cutting edge of movement, you know. I think, you know, Freudian stuff. And then, you know, even though there's been tremendous changes, is still stuck a little bit in the 19th century. And I need for myself to break free of that.
In terms of using impact, I write to you and I write as a supplicant. I write to you out of nowhere, and I go to the International Movie Database, and I find out who your agent is, and I write to them, and I send you this letter, like, in February of 2009. That was when it was. Well, 9 months later, you call me and say, oh, okay, I'll do this. Right? How does that happen?
Yeah, yeah. And what happens is that there's a long time before it gets from the agency to me, because they're an animal. Frankly, their focus is not on this. Their focus is, you know, from Harvard Business School. They're making deals, and many of them really have no clue about the mechanics, the simple mechanics of making a movie, which is why there's so much strife. And so things move slowly. And then for my own thing, I was in the midst of going off right then to Morocco to do Mary Mother of Christ. And that got its financing collapse with the rest of the world's financial collapse. And so it just got put off. But I'm really, really glad that you persisted. And and then I got felled by pig disease.
Right. So when after that first call, okay, immediately I go out and I watch five more movies and of yours, and I listen to the director's comments on the movies where you made director's comments, and I start to understand how you think, and I start to understand your language pattern. I write you back another letter where I'm more intensely attuning myself to the way in which you respond and the way in which you think and some of the words and concepts and metaphors that you use. I write you back another letter, and I wonder if by virtue of doing that, I have impact.
Oh, my God, yes. Uh-huh. And I love emails for that reason, and I hate because I take my emails seriously because they're written down, and even to the point where I really use the spell check. I can't stand misspellings in emails. And so I respond to whatever somebody's giving me. I feel like I want to respond in kind. And to be honest, when you were first proposing and talking about, I felt a slight, I wouldn't call it intimidation, but a slight trepidation that I was so unlearned in the discipline that you're operating in that I wouldn't know how to connect, you know, the movies to what you're talking about. But after this conversation, I certainly do, and it certainly has piqued my interest in a tremendous way. Uh-huh. And I'm going to gobble up stuff and be searching the net.
If I can be a conduit, then you've got me.
Yeah, I appreciate that.